as she felt the old poison oozing up inside her. "You have a task. This is a time for intellect, not passion." After the performance, the guests had dispersed to various amusements before dinner. Mara had followed the Master of Keys. If Yarin's intelligence was correct, he wouldn't be at any of the feasts, so Mara had to ensure he didn't go back to his chambers to give Grubb time to find the vault key. She'd need to engage him somehow, but to do that, she had to draw him from his circle. For an unaccompanied woman to approach a man was brazen behaviour in Croden High Society, and she'd lost her escort when Harrod left her. Alone, these men would ignore her at best, patronise her at worst. Even if her pride could suffer it, that was no way to impress him. As she was considering her strategy, she felt a touch at her elbow. She knew who it was before she heard his voice. "Mara?" The Ossian by her side was broad-chested, his proportions bear-like, with hairy hands and a neat brown beard. His Croden jacket and trousers were cut from expensive cloth, but he was ill at ease in such finery. She supposed all the money in the world would never change that. "I am Lady Harforth of Harrow, if it please you," Mara told him. He looked even more awkward. "And where is your lord?" "On some nefarious business elsewhere," she said. "But I believe I know you. Aren't you the famed Maliard, inventor of the Maliard limb?" "Mara," he said again, his tone somewhere between pleading and warning. "Mara, don't torment me. Mara, don't embarrass yourself. Mara, don't get out of hand." He was Ossian, but his words were flattened by Gultic inflections, a gift from his father, as was his surname. She took a breath to say something caustic, then checked herself with a sigh of resignation. She was imagining conflict when there was none. He wasn't her enemy, quite the opposite, but she'd been caught off guard. "I did not think you would be here," she said, as an apology of sorts. "I'm leaving soon. I came as a favour to the man who arranged your invitation." He had the grace to look shamefaced. "He asked me to meet his son. The boy wants to be an inventor."
"Inspiring the next generation. Admirable."
"Don't. I'm only here for your sake."
"And now you're checking on me. For my sake."
"Yes," he said. "Exactly.
Lady Harforth? What are you up to?"
"Merely trying to advance my position in society," she said. "We women must do what we can to get ourselves noticed in these challenging days." She smiled without humour. "But you've heard my thoughts on that subject many times."
"Please be careful, that's all. The Iron Hand are everywhere. I don't know what you're doing, but as you're under a false name, I assume it isn't good."
"Good is a relative concept, don't you think?" she said. "It rather depends on your point of view. I wonder if the Crodans consider themselves villains, or the Ellaru, or the Erds."
He checked no one was close enough to overhear, then gave her an exasperated glance. She took some small glee in that. She hoped he'd argue the point with her, but he didn't rise to it. Once he'd enjoyed their sparring, the cut and thrust of argument. Now he found it tiresome, and that grieved her.
"I hear congratulations are in order," she said. He gave her a puzzled frown. "Ariala is with child again."
The horror on his face would have been amusing if she hadn't been dying inside.
"Oh, Danric, it's quite all right. I didn't want children, remember?"
But she'd never been a good liar, and her fragile smile did nothing to conceal the hurt of old wounds reopening, all the more painful because his had long since healed. She hated herself for wanting him, hated the wistful need she felt in his presence.
"I should go," said Danric, as he saw the turn things were taking.
"Not yet," she said, more urgently than she'd intended. She composed herself and spoke more calmly. "One last favour, please."
"This was a mistake," he said. "I didn't mean to..."
"Danric," she said, growing flinty. "Your new baby will be delivered by the best Croden doctors. They will have the finest education, eat good food, and live in a safe neighbourhood.
You and yours have health and security and want for nothing. You owe me for that."
His eyes lost their softness. He didn't like to be reminded that his wealth and success came from her, not earned but given. Perhaps that was her goal when she approached him with the idea in the months after they broke up. She'd thought there was still hope for them then, and meant to chain him close with bonds of obligation to prove he could never do better than her. In the end, it had the opposite effect, fostering resentment in them both until they had no choice but to cut off contact altogether. She saw that same resentment in him now. "What do you need?" he said coldly. The sullen anger in his voice wounded her afresh, but she'd suffer the scars if it brought them the ember blade. "Introduce me to the Master of Keys," she said, nodding towards her quarry. "Tell him I am fascinated by his work and wish to hear all about it. I am Lady Harforth, a dear friend of yours from Harrow."
"Very well," he said. "Whatever plan you have in mind, I am already damned by inviting you."
He walked away without waiting for reply, brusque enough to be insulting. She followed him. In the weeks and years to come, if she lived to see them, she'd pore over this meeting and relive the chill agony of his anger like hollow icicles in her guts. But there was more at stake than her feelings, so she built her walls, bricking up the hurt inside. By the time they reached the Master of Keys, she was composed and ready to play the game.
"Your pardon," said Danric as he reached the group.
"Maliard," said the youngest of the men. He was an acquaintance of Danric's, and obviously quite impressed and excited by the fact.
"This is Danric Maliard," he told the others, "inventor of the Maliard limb. A fine fellow, be assured."
Greetings were exchanged, friendly smiles and handshakes. When the men were done with their welcomes, Danric gestured to Mara, whom no one had acknowledged till now.
"May I introduce Lady Harforth of Harrow? She is a dear friend of mine, and she is so full of questions about the Master of Keys that I thought you two should meet."
"Oho," cried the Master, preening. "Questions, is it? I shall be glad to answer. Jarrett Ban, Master of Keys at Hammerholt, at your service."
"So kind of you to take the time to indulge my curiosity," said Mara, affecting a Harish accent. "Tell me, is it true you have the Ember Blade here in Hammerholt?"
The other men chuckled and exchanged indulgent glances. Mara seethed inwardly, but she kept her tongue still. She knew the role she must play if she wanted to keep him busy. Intelligence was disconcerting. Assertiveness meant she was uppity. Pleasant deference was all that remained.
"It is indeed true," said the Master, his thick-fingered hands folded over the large gold medallion that rested on his belly. "The Ember Blade is secured in a vault in the heights of this very fortress, waiting to be delivered to Prince Otico on his wedding day."
"Ossia's most prized relic," she said. "It is a great responsibility you carry. What if some thief should pick the lock?"
"My lady, I welcome them to try," he guffawed. "They would have a hard time finding a lock to pick."
"I don't understand," said Mara, with a confused smile.
"The vault door is quite unbreakable, and there is no keyhole in it. The mechanism that secures it is a wonder of Croden craftsmanship, installed to replace the inferior Ossian version after Hammerholt was taken. But to say more would be indiscreet. And I am nothing if not discreet."
The men laughed at this. Some shared joke she was excluded from. Before the conversation could turn away from her, she asked him another question about his duties in Hammerholt. The Master of Keys was flattered by her interest and happy to describe his day at length. Soon his companions lost interest and began to talk among themselves. Danric excused himself with a last warning glance at Mara. She ignored him, though her heart felt him go. Now that she had the Master to herself, she feigned fascination in order to learn more. He talked readily about things of little importance, but became cagey if she pressed him for details. It was good to have confirmation that the Ember Blade was in Hammerholt, and being kept exactly where they thought, but his cryptic hints about the vault door bothered her. If there was no key,
then how was the door to be opened? She needed to find out, but she dared not press too hard for fear of arousing his suspicions. Time and again she was forced to dance away from the subject, and time danced away from her. They were interrupted by a servant ringing a bell, asking those guests who were dining to take their places.
"Madam," said the master, "it has been a pleasure, but I really must retire."
"Oh, you are not dining?" Mara asked.
"I am not," he said.
He patted his stomach and gave her a rueful smile.
"My doctor advises I stay away from feasts and strong drink, and I fear my will is weak. I will take a small meal in my study with my books for company."
"Ah," she gave a regretful sigh. "I am no lover of raucous feasts either. Would that we could continue our conversation in some quiet spot instead." It was a desperate ploy, and she was ashamed of it, but she'd never had the art of light conversation. The Master of Keys looked a little embarrassed on her behalf. Croden's thought it unseemly for a woman to go off alone with a man at a party, unless she was a certain sort.
"I would like nothing more," he lied, "but I'm sure a lady of such grace would be missed at the dining-table."
He was attempting to get away with as much elegance as he could muster. Mara felt a flutter of panic. She couldn't let him go. This was her task, and she was failing it, and she wasn't used to failing anything. She snatched for an idea and blurted it out. "Do you think a woman could ever be the Master of Keys?" Her question stopped him, and several of his cohorts turned back in the act of leaving. Suddenly, everyone was interested in their conversation. Mara saw one man hiding a smirk behind his hand.
"Well, whatever do you mean?"
the master floundered. "You must forgive my pestering you with questions, but they were all for a purpose," Mara improvised frantically. "It has been something of a foolish desire of mine to one day call myself Mistress of Keys in some wondrous old castle." One of the men snorted down a laugh and was quietly struck by his companion, who was also trying to keep his composure. It was so absurd a wish that Mara blushed.
"And why not?" she asked them defiantly. "Why should it not be so?"
"Well, there are many good reasons, I'm sure," said the master.
"Name some," one of his companions urged, enjoying the master's discomfort. The other man snorted again. The master shot him a venomous look.
"It's just... well, the post of the Master of Keys requires an immense capacity for organization, you see. I am in charge of the security and care of many precious objects. I see to the safety of a large number of important individuals. With so many considerations to account for, it requires a level of logical and tactical thinking that, I'm sorry to say, is beyond the capacity of a woman. A lady's mind is more inclined towards nurture and care, the conversational arts and certain crafts at which they exceed."
Mara smiled sweetly to conceal the fact that her blood was boiling.
"Logical and tactical thinking, you say? Such as might be employed in a game of castles?"
"Exactly so," said the master triumphantly.
He threw his arms wide, appealing to his fellows.
"I have played castles since I was at my father's knee. Hundreds of games against all manner of opponents. And never once, not once, have I been beaten by a woman."
Mara raised an eyebrow. 91. Clisson hurried through the corridors of Hammerholt, heart limping at his heels. By his side was a young underwatchman called Oslett, freshly blooded, lean and eager. Oslett might have been guiding them, but Clisson set the pace, keeping it brisk enough to make Hart struggle. Tormenting his subordinate had begun as a necessity, but ended up as a habit.
"The prisoner is just down here, overwatchman," said Oslett.
They passed doorways that rang with the sound of cutlery and conversation, pulsing waves of sweaty heat out into the cool corridors. The formal dining rooms were on the floor above. This floor was for the guests' retinues, their footmen, servants and guards. Their feasts had all the noisy ruckus of a beer hall. Worry put speed in his step. The royal wedding was a prime target for every dissident in Ossia, and the Iron Hand was on high alert. But despite the danger, they had strict orders to conduct their business out of sight. Whatever happened behind the scenes, the prince wasn't to be troubled. Yet Clisson heard that he had been troubled by a Sard lutist with a seditious song. A Sard lutist. It cannot be a coincidence. At least Oslit had come to him with the news, and not the commander. Clisson had already been chewed out by that senile old fool once today. It wasn't enough to capture the most wanted man in Ossia, apparently. He should have brought in the whole Morganholm network with him. Commander Gossen had demanded to know why he'd let Aaron go, why they hadn't rearrested Kiel when they had the chance, and tortured him to make him talk. When Garrick hanged at dawn, the Iron Hand would lose their only link to the Morganholm rebels. So why had he done it? Because I know my job, you withered old bastard. Because neither Kiel nor Aaron would have talked in time if I'd tried to make them sell out the whole group. Because I made a deal, and I honour my deals, for I represent an empire which is fair and just. Without their Dawn Warden, they're a headless rabble not worth the effort of hunting, and the most they'll manage from now on is some mildly offensive graffiti. Also, it's hardly my fault if the higher-ups would rather hang Garrick for show than give us the time to interrogate him. But there was a worm of doubt in his mind. He'd misread the boy, he had to admit that. He'd waited in a dark, cold house in the ghetto with his men, but Aaron had never come. The humiliation of ordering his men home wasn't one he'd soon forget. He wouldn't make the mistake of being merciful a second time. When Garrick swung from a rope tomorrow at dawn, Clisson would be there to collect the glory. The Chancellor could hardly refuse him the position of commander then. Gossen would go back to Croda to live out his twilight years in the motherland, and his lickspittle Betren would be out in the cold. Unless the commander was right, unless Garrick's companions managed to make trouble without him. Oslit led them to a small disused room on the edge of a vacant wing of the fortress. Captain Dressel was there, with another grim-faced guardsman and a watchman second class of equivalent rank to Hart. The prisoner, who'd been seated in a chair, sprang to his feet as Clisson entered.
"I didn't know," he cried. "By the Primus, you must believe me. The Sard bitch was sent to ruin me."
Dressel moved to intercept him, but Clisson held up a hand. The prisoner was an angry dandy, and Clisson despised him on sight. But he was desperate to talk, and Clisson was of a mind to let him.
"I am Edgan, leader of the finest musical troupe in Morganholm," he gushed, relieved that someone was finally listening. "Yesterday our lutist fell ill, likely to a poison administered by my rival, and that very day I met a Sard with the skills to fill her place. I should have known then, but alas, I was too eager to perform for the prince to see the trap. I had no idea she would play such a scandalous song for His Highness. I tried to arrest her myself, but I was stopped, so I reported her to the Iron Hand. I had nothing to do with—"
"Stopped?" Clisson interrupted him. "By whom?"
"A Harish. A noble sort. Tall. His hair was cut in that ridiculous style they favour, as if a dome had been placed upon his head and a blade passed around it."
Clisson felt his guts tighten. A Sard lutist and a Harish noble. The same couple that had been at the Reaver's Rest. There was no question then. "Captain Dressel, take some men and go to the dungeons at once. Secure the prisoner. No one sees him until I tell you otherwise."
"Yes, Overwatchman. Hail to the Emperor."
He saluted and left, taking the other guard with him. Clisson looked at the watchman standing by the door.
"You did well to bring this to my attention. Keep this man here, out of the way. I'll deal with him later."
"But I—"
Edgan began. A sharp look from Clisson persuaded him of the advisability of silence. He sank fretfully back into his chair.
"Watchman Hart, find the Sard and the man called Harod. Use whoever you need, on my authority. But for the Primus's sake, be discreet about it."
"What will you do?"
Hart asked.
"There are two here we know of," said Clisson. "There may be others."
He pulled open the door and headed up the corridor, fear nipping at his heels. "They're a rabble," he reassured himself firmly. "Tie two Ossians to a cart and they'll pull in different directions. They're harmless without their leader." But he was going to find the Master of Keys, just in case.
92. The sewers beneath Hammerholt were a maze of tunnels, where narrow stone paths ran alongside reeking waterways criss-crossed by crumbling bridges. The water was restless and high, lapping over the path in places. Grubb's boots splashed in the puddles as he lumbered along, lantern brandished before him to fend off the dark. The others were heading for the dungeon and Garrick, but Grubb's mission took him elsewhere. He had a map with him, sketched out and kept in a sealed watertight tube, but he hadn't needed it yet, preferring to navigate by instinct and memory. He went with haste, spurred on by the desire to keep ahead of the rising water and the terror that followed him in his mind. He couldn't forget what had happened in that cave. The feeling of his strength draining away, that final sigh before the water closed over his head and he went slipping into the dark. As his senses faded and his thoughts went still, he'd reached the borders of death and glimpsed what waited for him there. Nothing. Emptiness. No bone god to welcome or damn him. He wouldn't even be afforded that grace. Not for him the ice fields of Kutak, where heroes hunted mighty Shaboths and battled giants in the snow. He wouldn't see the halls of Vanatuk, where there was feasting and merriment and hearths that burned eternally. His fate was the forgetting, where the unremembered went when they died. He'd seen it as he sank into the black abyss, and it struck fear into him such as he'd never known. But Mudslug had saved him. Dumbface told him so. Mudslug went after him and pulled him out of the water. Mudslug had spared him the forgetting, given him a second chance, a chance he meant to seize with both hands. Only the Ember Blade could keep him from that black hell. Only the Ember Blade could buy him forgiveness from the Bone God. He had to have it. The water was lapping around his ankles by the time he found the stairway. Mudslug said the sewers would keep flooding until the water level fell in the cave, and it was impossible to push the door shut against the force of the water gushing through it. The cave would drain out again in time, but it didn't much matter, as their boat would likely have sunk by then. Untying it from its moorings had allowed them to survive, but it might also have shut off their best route out. Without some kind of boat, they couldn't escape back to the lake. They'd resolved to keep their original rendezvous for now, banking on the slim chance that the boat had managed to stay afloat. But if the alarm was raised, they'd have to take the alternative option. They'd head for the excavation site on the far side of Hammerholt and the unknown depths beneath. Grubb grunted to himself. He'd take some Erd ruins over going back in that water. Skarls didn't fear the deep earth. They lived half their lives underground and could keep their bearings without sun or sky to guide them. Besides, there was more chance for adventure there. He came to a sturdy door at the top of the stairs and found it locked. Listening at the keyhole, he heard nothing, so he drew his lockpicks from a soggy pouch. He was cold and his fingers were numb, but no Skarl paid much mind to such small discomforts. In short order, he heard the lock click.
"Grubb is the greatest," he muttered to himself.
In absence of anyone else to boast to, it made him feel better. He pushed the creaking door open into an unlit corridor, chilly and austere. Faint moonlight made its way through the windows. Grubb grinned in satisfaction. Deserted, as he'd hoped. This part of Hammerholt was being rebuilt in the Croden style, having long fallen into disrepair. It wasn't trafficked by anyone but workmen, who'd all been sent home till the wedding was over. He blew out his lantern and slid into the corridor. The chambers of the Master of Keys were several levels above him, according to the map, but he'd never get to them by passing through the busy area that surrounded it.
His was a more direct route, straight up the wall outside. He drew out his map and frowned over it for a short time. Once he had the route set in his mind, he headed off again, down lonely ways where tattered strands of spiderweb waved in the breeze and the dry bodies of mice lay in corners among the dust and pebbles. As he went, his mind turned to Mudslug, and he felt a pang of guilt sharp enough to surprise him. Guilt wasn't an emotion he was used to, at least not where foreigners were concerned. He knew Dumbface would curse his name when he stole the Ember Blade, and Painted Lady would spit, and Freckles and the others would all hate him. But it was the thought of Mudslug's disappointment that stung. Mudslug had been on his side when no one else was. Mudslug had saved him from the forgetting. Stealing the blade felt like a poor way to repay him. He'd had loyalty once, and honour of a sort. Back in Caraca, he was part of an orphan gang. They'd all looked after each other, comforted one another when they were beaten, mourned when one of them got hanged. The camaraderie of thieves made them strong. Even when you didn't like someone, you backed them up because they were one of yours. The old man taught them that. He was a poor father figure, but he was what they had. Maybe he'd always been trying to get back to those days, the warmest he remembered in a cold, hard life. Maybe that was why he'd stolen another man's skin. But his own motivations were murky to him. He'd always been driven by forces he didn't understand. His instinct now was to save himself. The somber men would forgive him. The skin scribes would erase his crimes. The stone singers would carve his deeds on towering obsidian stelae. And he'd be a hero again, this time forever. So why did he feel bad about it? A door opened ahead of him, hurrying footsteps, a light approaching. He was caught in the open, halfway down a corridor, and the stranger was coming too fast to find good cover. Next to him was a door in a recessed alcove. He tried it, but it was locked, and he had no time to pick it. Instead, he pressed himself up against the stone of the alcove and went still. She came towards him on soft feet, a girl by her breath and the weight of her. She moved with haste, late for something, or on some urgent errand. What was she doing here, in these abandoned parts? It didn't matter. All that mattered was that she wasn't allowed to raise the alarm. Grubb drew his dagger, the blade whispering against the sheath. The light brightened as the girl passed him. She was plump, with blonde hair in a long braid. Her cheeks flushed and her eyes fixed forward. In her hurry she didn't see him, and she headed off and up the corridor. Then, suddenly, she came to a halt. Grubb gripped his dagger harder, his muscles tensing, ready to spring. If she turned, she'd spot him. She was looking down at the floor, her lantern held up for a better view. Grubb followed her gaze and saw what had stopped her. Water. Fat spatters of water in a trail along the stony floor. Coming from ahead and leading away behind her. Leading to Grubb. He heard the change in her breathing. There was fear now. The fear of strange things happening in dark places. Perhaps she sensed his eyes on her. Perhaps she felt some premonition of his hand clamping round her mouth, his blade piercing her back. If she turned... He saw her shoulders hunch, a child afraid of phantoms, suddenly vulnerable in the dark. She dared not look behind her, dreading what she might find there. Whatever that water meant, she didn't want to know. She hurried off down the corridor and never turned. And so she lived. Grubb put his knife back in its sheath and waited till she was gone. Then he emerged from the alcove and walked away. He counted doors until he reached the one he wanted. It wasn't locked. Peering through, he found a grey room, stark and empty in the moonlight, with a rumpled bed of rugs and ramskins laid in the corner. The air swam with the smell of sex. Grubb leered as he realized why the girl had been down here. A secret tryst before heading back to her duties. Where was her partner then?
gone another way with luck. Otherwise they might find themselves on the point of his dagger. He crossed the room and found another door there. Cold air blew in around the edges. It was locked, so he knelt down and picked it, alert for movement behind him. The hall beyond was open to the sky, the stars glittering overhead. Tantera hung high above, with Lyssa beside her. One wall was mostly in ruins, with scaffolding all along its length. Through an archway, Grubb could see another hall in even worse repair, the walls held up with iron props. The scaffold was an easy climb for someone of Grubb's rare talent. When he got to the top, he manoeuvred himself out onto the broken wall. Hammerholt towered overhead, enormous in its might. All around, the jagged tips of the Catsclaw Mountains shone like frozen waves in the moonlight. He crouched there, the wind chilling him in his wet clothes, and sniffed back a runnel of watery snot. He'd lived in Ossia longer than he'd lived in his homeland. Funny to think about that. Neither country had been kind, but Ossia at least hadn't rejected him. From this vantage point, he could see for leagues about, and it brought an odd contentment. Winter would come soon, but here in Ossia there'd be no deadly blizzards of ice shards, no fanged predators raiding the villages, no sacrifices to the blood witches. Ossia was a gentle place compared to the land of his birth. For the first time, he began to wonder why he was so keen to go back. He shrugged off the thought with a grunt. There was work to be done. He wiped his nose with one wet sleeve and looked up. Several stories above him was the window he wanted. Maybe he hadn't killed an ice bear. Maybe he hadn't ambushed a shipload of Boscan smugglers. But nobody could climb like he could. He flexed his fingers and rolled his shoulders. Time to earn another tattoo. 93. The dungeon was quiet and all but empty, far from the celebrations on the floors above. The only sounds were the prisoner shifting in his cell, and the steady snap of the jailer's cards as he played one up with himself next to a glowing brazier. Snap, snap, snap. He sat at the head of a short, shadowy corridor, with several cells running along one side. Various doorways led off it, leading to a privy, a storeroom, and a small torture chamber, which was nevertheless large enough to accommodate great magnitudes of pain. The prisoner was in the cell at the end, slumped in the shadows. Snap, snap, snap. The jailer was a thick-set man with a flat, broken nose, his hair shaved to disguise the fact that he was losing it. He scooped up the two piles of cards, shuffled them together, and started turning them again. Snap. Snap. An animal whine and a scratch at the door made him look up. He put down his cards and made his way over to investigate. The door was thick wood reinforced with iron, with a barred window at face height. As he was about to look through, a hound's face appeared there, grey and lean and bearded like a ragged old man. Standing on its hind legs, it was taller than he was. Ruck woofed in a friendly manner. "Hey, boy," said the jailer. "Where's your master?" Ruck's tongue lolled and she panted. The jailer put his hand up to the window, and she sniffed and licked it. He was pleased with that. "Anyone out there?" he called, but the corridor was empty. "Huh," he said. "Lost, are you? All kinds running around up there, eh? Surprised you didn't find your way to a feast." He took out his keys and unlocked the door. "Come on in, then. It's warmer in here, and you'll make better company than my prisoner. Better conversation, too, I reckon." Ruck dropped away from the window as he opened the door. But she didn't come in. Instead, she loped off up the corridor to the T-junction at the end and looked back with a whine. "You coming in or not?" the jailer demanded. Ruck whined again. A look of dawning comprehension crept over the jailer's battered face. "Something you want to show me?" he asked.
Rock barked. The jailer sighed and looked over his shoulder at the prisoner. His legs were visible. The rest of him was hidden in a fold of dark.
"Sorry, I ain't supposed to leave my post," he said.
Rock barked again with dumb insistence. The jailer rolled his eyes.
"Just to the corner, then. I ain't going further than that."
He lumbered up the corridor to Ruck, but as soon as he came close, she barked and darted out of sight.
"Oi, come on," the jailer groaned as he turned the corner after her.
Standing there, bow drawn and an arrow aimed at his chest, was Fenn. The jailer stared at her in blank surprise as Vika lunged from the shadows behind him and clamped a wadded rag over his nose and mouth. The paint on her face had smeared and run, turning her into something primal and horrific, a fearful demon from an elder age. The jailer gave a muffled cry and shoved back against her, crashing her up against a wall. But Vika was tough as a root, and she held firm until his eyes rolled up and he crumpled to the floor. Fenn lowered her bow as Aaron emerged from an alcove behind her, his sword ready in his hand. Cade, Harrod, and Orica came with him. Cade squatted down by the jailer and prodded him in the nose with his forefinger.
"That's incredible," he said. "Is he asleep?"
"He is unconscious," said Vika, "and will remain so for some hours."
"All because he smelled that potion?"
"It's remarkable what a few herbs and a little woodcraft can achieve." The druidess was being modest. Aaron knew she'd spent hours preparing her potions in the safe house, locked away with her strange rituals. He'd seen the orders she'd sent to the city herbalist, calling for rare ingredients she usually collected by hand. Vika's art paled in comparison to the sorceries of the Second Empire, if the legends were true, but there was power in her concoctions far greater than any apothecary could muster. Aaron took the keys from the jailer's belt. He was glad they hadn't needed to kill him. Croden or not, he was just doing his job. "Lock him in a cell," he told the others, as he hurried towards the dungeon, his sword in his hand and excitement in his step. He knew it was selfish and silly, but he wanted his face to be the first Garrick saw. He wanted him to know who'd rescued him. "Garrick," he called, as he entered the dungeon. The light from the brazier made it hard to see to the back, and he passed several empty cells before he saw the figure sitting in the last one. "Garrick, is that you?" The prisoner surged clumsily to his feet, his hands gripping the bars. When Aaron reached him, there was a look of such disbelief and amazement on his face that Aaron could do nothing but grin breathlessly. Neither of them knew what to say. He was tattered and sallow, wearing rough-spun prison garb, his hair and beard shaved off. But he was here, and alive.
"How?"
he managed, eventually looking Aaron up and down. Aaron was still sodden, his clothes sticking to him in places.
"That's a long story," Aaron said.
Then, because he couldn't think of anything else, "Are they keeping you comfortable in there?"
"Not really."
"Let's get you out, then." Aaron unlocked the cell door and pushed it open as the others came up behind him, dragging the unconscious jailer. Garrick moved to the door of the cell. His features looked all wrong without his hair and beard to frame them, and the deep scar across his throat was stark and repulsive, but his eyes were as fierce as ever. In a rush of relief, Aaron stepped forward and hugged him hard. Garrick's hiss of indrawn breath sent him stepping back quickly, uncertain whether he'd overstepped the mark. Then he saw the new scars peeping out from the collar of Garrick's shirt, and his torn sleeves, the raw seeping pads where the fingernails of his left hand used to be, the weary, injured way he held himself.
"They cut you where it won't show," Garrick said, his voice low and grim. "Cut you, and worse. Wouldn't do their image good to have my face all bruised up when the crowd come to see me hang."
"They tortured you?"
He grinned. There were two teeth missing on the right side.
"They tried," he said.
"'Reckon Clisson would have loved to keep me longer, "'but the powers that be want me in a noose before the princess arrives. "'I gave them nothing.' "'He spat it with furious pride. "'The others had crowded up behind Aaron in the corridor. "'Aaron unstrapped Garrick's sword from his belt and held it out. "'Garrick took it, turning it this way and that, "'studying it as if it were something unfamiliar. "'Keel?' he asked. "'We don't know. He's gone.' Vika stepped up beside Aaron.
"'Are you ready to take back the Ember Blade, Garrick?'
"'You're going to steal the Ember Blade?' Garrick asked in surprise.
"'Of course,' said Aaron, puzzled. "'Weren't you?'
His gaze fell on Aaron. "'And all this was your idea, I take it?'
"'Mine and Mara's,' he said, suddenly worried he'd done something wrong. But there was pride, not anger, in Garrick's eyes.
"'Shades, I'd never have believed it,' he said quietly. "'If Ossia has more like you, let her enemies beware. "'It's almost enough to give a man back his faith.'
Happiness filled Aaron like the light of a dawning sun. To win such praise from a Dawn Warden, from Garrick, made him feel invincible. He fought to keep the smile off his face. "'Almost?' he asked mischievously. "'Aaron!' It was Fenn from the dungeon doorway. "'Men coming! A lot of them, in armour!'
Aaron was serious again in an instant.
"'Move!' he snapped. "'We can't face them here. We'll be trapped!'
They were quick to obey, leaving the jailer on the floor as they ran for the door.
Aaron turned to Garrick, brusque now, all business. "'Can you fight?' he demanded.
"'Against Crodans?' Garrick drew his sword and let the sheath clatter to the floor. Always.
94. Mara picked up an ivory trebuchet from the castle's board and hovered it over the battlefield, pretending to dither. Across from her was the Master of Keys, wearing a smugly indulgent smile on his face. She had his measure entirely. He was monotonously aggressive and easy to predict. With a swift break for the high ground and her knights sweeping in from the side, she could ruin him.
"'There are so many factors to consider, aren't there?' oozed the Master of Keys. "'It's enough to muddle anybody. Do take your time.'
Taking her time was exactly what she was doing. She agonized over every action, feigning indecision. She picked up pieces and put them down again, humming and hawing all the while. The master endured it all with the patience of a father teaching an infant, having been confident of victory from the very first move. As long as he was beating her, he was content.
"'Tactical and logical thinking, remember?' said the master as she wavered again. "'Now imagine having to do this every day. That is what it takes to be a master. Forgive me, a mistress of keys.'
He gave a knowing glance to one of his companions, a mustachioed young Crodan called Talon. Several more people were observing the game. One, an Ossian, had brought his wife to watch too. Some were supposed to be feasting, but they wanted to see how this turned out. Men enjoyed a wager, even if it was only pride at stake, and Mara's challenge had intrigued them. She guessed that no one would be sad to see the master lose. Everyone liked to see a braggart taken down a peg, but it would be equally satisfying to see a mud-headed woman with delusions of grandeur learn the error of her ways. It was win-win as far as they were concerned. She looked over the board. Her pieces were few, and getting fewer. If she lost many more, she wouldn't be able to win the game, and she'd delayed him a good while already. She could begin to fight back by moving her trebuchet to that hill, overlooking the river of counters which divided the board. She moved it backwards instead, withdrawing it to defend one of the two castles she still held.
"'Ah, a defensive move. Very wise,' said the master. "'But perhaps you did not see how it leaves your eagle exposed to my assassin, thus—'
He slid his piece across the board and tapped it against her eagle.
"'Well, we must all make sacrifices,' she said with a tight smile.
It was good that she'd had a few glasses of wine. She'd need a couple of bottles later to wash away the shame. Sacrifices, she'd made more than her share. A lifetime's potential sacrificed on the altar of Croden belief. Her genius smothered, her voice silenced, her only great contribution to the world credited to her former lover. So many times she'd bitten her tongue, bowed her head, dimmed her light so as not to outshine a man, and now she was forced to do it again, for Grubb's sake, for the cause.
"Might I suggest reinforcing your left flank? You're rather exposed there," said the master helpfully.
"So I am," she said in mock surprise. "Thank you for your advice. Perhaps a swordsman would bolster my forces?"
"Ah,"
the master sounded uncertain. "You have another idea?"
"Have you considered that the giant might offer better protection?"
"Of course he would," said Mara. "Thank you. Thank you for telling me how to play my own pieces against you, you patronizing bastard."
"Here, allow me."
He reached across the table and moved her piece for her. It was all Mara could do not to slap him. "I see," was all she could manage, almost choking on her rage.
"Now, ha-ha, I seem to have stymied my own next move," he chuckled. "There's a giant in the way now. I'd better think again."
"Don't despair. There is a way through every barrier."
"Oh, not every barrier," the master replied. "Otherwise I'd have no job."
"I must disagree. Surely there must be someone out there clever enough to get through your mysterious vault door."
"You are worried about thieves, aren't you?"
"Well, the Ember Blade is quite a target, and I've heard Ossians have a rebellious streak. Look at Salt Fork."
"Salt Fork? Ha! The average Ossian can't get on with his neighbour long enough to borrow a pair of shears. Present company excluded, of course," he added, nodding to the Ossians in the audience.
"No need to apologise, Jarrett. You're quite right," said Lord Hewitt, a lanky man with a sharp nose. "Weak stock, that's what this country has. No discipline or willpower in the common folk. Half of them are barely better than animals. Only bloodlines worth a damn are the nobility."
Mara was finding it increasingly difficult to contain herself. She wanted to rain righteous truth down on these insufferably superior fools. She met the eyes of the only other woman present, Lady Hewitt, a raven-haired Ossian who'd once been swan-necked until age loosened her skin. Did she feel as Mara felt? Did she burn inside daily at the injustice? "Still," she said, returning her attention to the master, "if you can open the door, is it not possible someone else could?"
"Not without the key. There is only one, and I keep it safe."
Mara's face was a picture of innocent puzzlement. "But you said there was no key."
"My lady, I said there was no keyhole."
He absently moved a piece and took her other eagle.
"There is, however, a key, if not in the conventional sense."
"How intriguing. But a key can be stolen, surely." He gave a slightly exasperated chuckle.
"If the key to the vault were taken, I am quite sure I would notice in very short order."
There. She'd caught him. He'd finally dropped one hint too many. Distracted, unguarded, it never occurred to him that a woman approaching her elder years posed any kind of threat. Even her probing questions about the vault were dismissed as harmless curiosity, where a man would have been met with suspicion. "Of course you would notice if the key was gone," she thought, "because you're carrying it on your person." Grubb's mission was destined to fail. There was no key to be found in his chambers because the master had it with him. Yarin's spies had been wrong on that score. Whatever the nature of this key, the master sounded confident there was no chance of a thief making off with it. She didn't need to keep the master from his chambers any more. In fact, she should send him there as soon as possible. It was a dangerous ploy, but if anyone could get the key away from him, it was the light-fingered Skarl. No need to humour him further, then.
No need to smile and defer and lose with grace to pamper his ego. It was time to show him who she really was.
"Are you stuck?"
he asked, with that oily tone that felt like a pat on the head.
"Might I suggest you move your arch—"
"No, I think I'll do this," she said, shifting a piece out to the edge of the battlefield.
"Hm," said the master. "Well, of course it's your choice, but then I shall simply do this."
He slid his assassin across the board and took her piece.
"You must always think three moves ahead," he advised.
"I really just needed you to move your assassin," she told him, as her knight captured his trebuchet on the high ground between two of his castles.
"Oh-ho! Didn't see that one coming, did you, Jarrett?"
crowed Talon, who was more than a little drunk.
"Be assured it was all in the plan," said the master uncertainly.
He scanned the board, and his eyes lit up.
"As you see."
He swooped his eagle in, adding its value to the adjacent swordsman, and took the knight.
"There."
"Oh, very good," said Talon. "But I think you'll find—"
"You've exposed your giant," Mara finished, and took it.
"Exactly so," said Talon. "The lady has claws," one of the audience commented, enjoying Jarrett's increasing discomfort.
"Nonsense. She's merely realized at last that attack is the best defense. A little too late, though. As you can see, I have more than double her pieces."
"Battles have been won with worse odds," said Mara calmly. "Asandra's stand at Goodrook during the Third Purge. Renau's rout of the Royalists at Dern, which turned the tide of the Revolution. The Battle of Ravenspear, when the Norls turned on the Erds and Ogryn. Tactics trump superior numbers every time."
"You know your history," said the master,
staring at her in worried amazement. Suddenly he didn't recognize the woman in front of him. Then he shook himself, and his face firmed, as much as was possible with the excess of flesh that surrounded it.
"However, it will avail you nothing. I have superior numbers and superior tactics."
"Then make your move," said Mara, "and we shall see." Stung, he threw his forces into a reckless attack. Mara caved before it, skirmishing along his line, picking off the weakest and fastest pieces as his forces were stretched thin. He took a castle at considerable sacrifice. Then, while he was gloating, Mara slipped across the river and assassinated his dragon. Over the next few turns, the master began to understand what she'd done. Almost all his highly mobile pieces were gone, leaving him with a powerful but lumbering army, most of which was on the other side of the river from his king.
"Jarrett, I do believe she's beating you," said Lord Hewitt with delight.
"She is not beating me," he huffed. "I still have my most powerful pieces while she is reduced to the rank and file."
"Better get them back across the river fast, though," said Talon, chuckling.
The master was flustered now, the colour rising in his cheeks and his temper with it. His moves became hasty, striking out at anything he could hit. Mara dangled bait in front of him, sacrificing pieces to draw his troops away from their king's side, and he took it again and again. By the end, he even believed he was winning.
"Ha!"
he said, as he reached for an archer.
"Did you forget that the hill increases my archer's range? I can hit your swordsman from there."
A snort of laughter from the audience stopped him, and he glared at Talon in irritation.
"By the Primus, you're getting on my nerves," he complained.
"Haven't you noticed she's beaten you?"
Talon told him. The master's face went slack.
"No, she hasn't," he said.
Talon leaned over the board, tracing lines with his finger.
"Assassin here, swordsman here, knight here. Your king doesn't have enough moves to get up to that high ground, so there's nowhere he can go. Next turn, her archer moves to the high ground your king can't reach, and he's dead. No escape, no matter what you do."
He straightened and applauded, slowly but earnestly.
"Bravo, my lady, bravo."
The master was still furiously searching the board, seeking some way out, unable to understand how he'd come to this predicament. He wanted to cry cheat. She saw it. It would be so much easier than admitting he'd been bettered.
It would appear that some women have more logical and tactical minds than you give us credit for, she said, unable to resist twisting the knife.
The men in the audience guffawed, and the master went beetroot with anger. His chair screeched as he surged to his feet. He was being mocked now, and he didn't like it at all.
A very fine game, he managed to say through a strangled grimace. Excuse me, I must take my supper now.
With a stiff bow, he stormed away, the laughter of his fellows ringing in his ears. Mara got to her feet, a smile of raw satisfaction on her face. She basked in the glow of victory, and it was all the better for having rubbed his arrogant face in it. That had felt good, so very, very good.
"My lady," said Talon, full of boozy gallantry, "I must apologize for Jarrett's lack of grace. Perhaps you'd join us in a discourse on the great battles of history, among which your game of castles will no doubt soon be reckoned."
She caught the eye of Lady Hewitt, hoping to see a glimmer of satisfaction there, some appreciation that Mara had struck a small blow for their kind. But she was clearly appalled at Mara's behaviour, and looked away when she met her gaze. Mara should have expected no better, but still she was disappointed. Just as Ossians policed themselves, their self-interest keeping them under the Croden boot, so women policed each other more thoroughly than men ever could. Well, damn her. It'll all be different one day. We'll make it different.
"I thank you for your invitation," she said to Talon, "but I'm afraid I have somewhere else to be."
She swiped a glass of wine from a passing servant, raised it to them, and took a swig.
"Good night, gentlemen. Madam?"
With that, she swept away across the parlour and out through the door, buzzing with a feeling sweeter than any drink could deliver. 95. They crowded up the torchlit corridor, shoulder to shoulder, swords in hand. Aaron, Harrod, and Garrick were in the lead, the others behind. Aaron's mouth was dry with excitement and fear, muscles trembling with the anticipation of combat.
"You can do this," he told himself. "You can do it."
The enemy had their swords drawn by the time Aaron and the others hustled into view, warned by the sound of approaching footsteps. Aaron saw the double-barred cross of the Iron Hand on their armour and recognised the man at their head, Captain Dressel, who'd escorted him to the interrogation room after Hart captured him. Dressel's eyes hardened as he saw Aaron and then flicked to Garrick.
"Ferocia!"
Aaron cried, unable to contain the tension inside him. They charged and met their opponents in a jagged crash of steel. All of Aaron's training went out of his head the moment the fight began. What was left were the reactions and responses drilled into him by Master Oryk, as familiar as instinct. In the confines of the corridor, he was jostled from all sides, battling for space to swing his sword. Before him was a pug-nosed, black-bearded man with a scar across one eye. Just another face, meaning nothing. He wasn't a person but an obstacle. All Aaron needed to do was kill him. There was only space for three abreast in the corridor, but the Ossians had Harrod on their side, the calm force holding the centre. Dressel could barely get a blow in on him. His blade flashed here and there as he blocked and feinted, his stance rigid and his back stiff. Dressel quickly realised the way things would go in an even fight, and barked an order to fall back. Behind them, the corridor opened up into a wider room where the rest of his guardsmen could lend their swords. Aaron's opponent stepped back and swung. Aaron moved to block it, but Harrod's blade was there first. He turned his block into a thrust, driving his blade into the man's armpit. The soldier gaped and coughed blood. Aaron put his foot to his chest and sent him sprawling into the man behind him. Another soldier pushed in to fill the space, but there was the thump of a bowstring, and he fell with one of Fenn's arrows protruding from his mouth. Aaron glanced to the right and saw Garrick smash through his opponent's weak guard before hacking deep into his shoulder. The soldier screamed and blood spurted from the wound as Garrick yanked his blade free. Where Harrod was calm, Garrick was possessed, teeth gritted, fueled by a furnace of rage. Without his beard and hair, there was a raw, lean savagery to him, the look of a starving wolf. They pressed their advantage, and Dressel retreated under a rain of blows. He tripped over a fallen soldier and tumbled into the room behind him, his attackers spilling in after. Two more soldiers closed ranks to protect their captain before Harrod could impale him. One of them found themselves impaled in his stead. Aaron took a moment to size up the odds. There were half a dozen, including Dressel, spread across a square chamber that Aaron guessed was an unmanned guard post. He saw an empty weapons rack on the wall, a table and chairs, sacks piled near a battered supply chest. A torch burned in a rusty sconce, and a narrow staircase led upwards. The combat spread out inside the room. Ruck pushed past Aaron and pounced on a soldier, knocking him down in a tumble of fur and claw to savage his exposed face. He screamed in horror and pain as his cheek was ripped away from the bone beneath. One of his companions tried to break off from the fighting to help him, and Aaron took advantage of his distraction to press the attack. A lucky blow sheared the fingers off his opponent's sword hand, causing him to drop his weapon, and he stared at the stumps in shocked puzzlement before Aaron ran him through. Garrick, a ragged agent of vengeance, cut down another guard to Aaron's left. Angry as he was, he had a Dawn Warden's skill, and his blows were cunningly placed. He stepped past the fallen man, stalking Dressel, who was scrambling back on his elbows, yet to find his feet. Dressel saw him coming and reached for a sword that had landed near him, but he was too late. Garrick executed him with an overhead swing so hard that it chipped the stone beneath his body. The discipline of the last two guardsmen faltered and broke. One of them ran for the stairs and was shot through the back by Fenn. Vika flung a handful of red powder in the other soldier's face. He stumbled away, gagging, and Garrick cut him down. A handful of heartbeats after it had begun, it was over. Aaron stood among the carnage, panting, both hands on his sword hilt, as if expecting more enemies to appear. The only sound was huffing breath and the wet, desperate gargle of Ruck's victim as he tried to draw air through a torn-out throat. Soon his eyes glazed and he fell silent. Ruck, her muzzle bloody with gore, began to lick her paws. Harrod sheathed his blade. He looked absurd. His velvets and hose were splattered with blood, and his hair had dried in a jester's mop. But his face was impassive and serious as ever, and no one felt like laughing at him. Orica and Cade crept into the room now the fighting was done, Cade holding a sword out before her like some brave defender. Garrick surveyed the bodies scattered around the room. The tinny, sweet smell of fresh blood was thick in the air.
"Reckon anyone heard us?"
"The guards are all on the floors above, protecting the guests," said Aaron, "and these walls are thick. We may have been lucky." Garrick began moving between the bodies, examining them, searching for something.
"They came down here for me. That means they know we're here."
"Not necessarily," said Aaron. "Only that they suspect something. Maybe they were just being cautious. We don't know. So we go on." Garrick gave him a look, half amazed.
"You don't give up, do you?"
"Tires you out, doesn't it?" Cade commiserated. "Grubb's out there somewhere," said Aaron. "He's relying on us to be ready when he gets to the vault. I won't let him down. So that's where we're going."
"Not I," said Garrick.
He knelt down next to the guard that had been shot through the mouth and began unstrapping his armor. They stared at him in silence. "What do you mean, not I?" Aaron asked at last.
"You think you'll even get to the Ember Blade?"
Garrick replied, tugging off the guard's trousers.
"You're going to climb all the way up through this fortress, bedraggled and covered in blood, while the Crodans are on the alert and looking for you? Good luck with that. If I thought you'd listen, I'd tell you to turn around and get out of here while you still have your lives."
Aaron was aghast. The man before him had suddenly become a stranger. "We can make our way through the empty parts of the fortress, you know that," he argued, hurt and shocked. "You planned to do it yourself." His face slackened as a dreadful suspicion settled on him. "Didn't you?" "No," said Vika, who'd reached the same conclusion. "He didn't. Whatever he planned, he never meant to come back at all." Garrick met her eye briefly, then looked away, busying himself with stripping the armour.
"If I learned one lesson from Salt Fork, it was this. A man who overreaches cannot long keep hold of what he grasps. We were brave and eager and swift, but all we gained was death. The Amber Blade was always out of reach, Aaron. I don't know how you plan to break into the vault, nor how you plan to escape, nor how you mean to keep the blade if you get it. But I reckon you'll die if you try."
His words fell on them like stones, and Aaron wanted to punch him for saying them. They were a betrayal, after all they'd been through to free him.
"But one man," he went on, "one man disguised as one of the Iron Guard, he might be able to move among them."
He pulled his rough-spun shirt over his head, showing the crisscross of welts on his torso, the burns, the crudely stitched line where a nipple had been.
"One man might get close enough to strike a blow the Crodans won't soon forget."
"And the Ember Blade?" Vika asked.
"The Ember Blade is not enough," Garrick snapped. "It was never enough. Our people are too far gone. They collude with their masters against their own kin. They do not have the courage to risk what they have and fight. The Ember Blade belongs to the days before the Crodans came, and those days have already been forgotten. Hope will not inspire them, but fear might."
"Hope inspired me," Fenn said, and Aaron could hear she was as hurt as he was. "You promised us the Ember Blade and we followed you," Aaron told him. "We were once a great people and we still are. I know it. The blood of the wolf still flows in Ossian veins. They will rally to the Ember Blade."
"You don't have it yet," said Garrick. "And even if you did, they won't."
The cold certainty in his voice numbed Aaron. Nobody had expected this. Nobody knew what to do.
"When did you stop believing?" Aaron asked him, his voice small.
Garrick was pulling on the dead man's clothes and armour.
"You're young," he said, "and I admire your newfound patriotism. But it is newly found, Aaron, and hardly tested. I've been fighting this battle a lot longer than you."
He paused for a moment, pulled an undershirt over his head.
"You want to know when I stopped believing? When my closest friend sold me out to torture and death just like 30 years ago. All that struggle, and I'm right where I started, with a knife in my back."
Garrick sighed wearily.
"I'll not chase false hope any more."
"You are not the champion in my vision," Vika accused, her voice sharp with disgust.
Ruck growled at him.
"I never claimed to be," said Garrick, fixing on the greaves.
"What about your oath?" Cade cried. "You're a Dawn Warden."
"Aye, I'm a Dawn Warden for what that's worth. And I swore never to see the Ember Blade wielded by any but an Ossian. But if we're all killed trying to get it, as we likely will be, then it will be in Prince Otico's hands 2 days from now. You have my thanks for saving me, but my mission remains unchanged."
"What is your mission, then, if not to steal the Ember Blade?" Orica asked. Garrick ignored her as he finished strapping on the breastplate and threw the cloak over his back. The fit wasn't perfect, but it would pass. He pulled up his shirt till it sat tight under his chin and covered the scar at his throat.
"Milady asked you a question," said Harrod.
Garrick straightened, his face grim in the torchlight.
"I'm going to kill the prince," he said. "I'm going to kill General Dakin, who slaughtered the Dawn Wardens. I'm going to kill every high-ranking Croden I possibly can. And then I'm going to burn this place to the god's damned ground and bury the Ember Blade under so much rubble
it will lie in these mountains till time's end.
"The barrel's on the cart," said Aaron. He remembered Garrick had been interested in which storeroom they'd been taken to. "There's something in them, isn't there?" Garrick stared at him, levelly, and that was answer enough.
"I'm leaving now, to do what I must. Any man or woman who wishes to stop me, make your play. Elsewise, step aside."
No one spoke. Even if they had sure grounds to oppose him, none of them wanted to. They hadn't forgotten the man who'd led them all this way. They heard the dull conviction in his voice and saw the sword in his hand. He'd kill them if they tried to stop him, and they had enough enemies without fighting among themselves. He snatched up a helmet and pushed past them, back the way they'd come. Aaron held his gaze as he passed. "You're not the man I thought you were, Cadrach of Darkwater," Aaron said coldly.
"Nor are you, Aaron of Shoalpoint," said Garrick,
and there was no hatred, but rather a rough tenderness in his voice that made Aaron's heart hurt.
"I've never been so glad to be wrong."
Then he was gone, up the corridor and out of sight. Vico was the first to recover. "We should not dally. Time is against us."
We're still going for the Ember Blade, then?" Cade asked.
"Of course we're going for the Ember Blade, Mudwit," Aaron snapped. "Why else do you think we're here?" He stalked off towards the stairs, his mind swirling with black thoughts.
"All right, good,"
said Cade, a cheery grin springing to his face.
"Just check in."
96. The quiet of the Master of Keys study was punctured by the delicate tinkle of breaking glass. A desk stood in the moonlight next to a window set deep into the stone and covered by miniature curtains. From behind them came the soft sound of a bolt sliding back. The window squeaked open and cold air blew in, stirring the curtains. There was grunting, scraping, a muffled curse. Tattooed fingers dashed the curtains aside. There, squashed in the tiny window recess like some grotesque frog, was Grubb, his face stretched in a sour grimace.
"Mudslug never said window was so small," he huffed as he forced himself by stages through the gap, before finally slithering to the floor like a particularly recalcitrant turd.
He got to his feet, rubbing his hands together to chase away the icy chill. His fingers were numb, and the muscles in his arms and back ached. He glanced at the hearth, prepared but unlit, and wished for a fire there. No time to waste. Bossy Chops was supposed to be keeping the Master of Keys busy, but who'd want to talk to her for long? There was a door on the far side of the study, which Grubb reckoned led to the corridor outside. A quick scout through the other doorway revealed a bedroom with a shrine to the Primus. From there, a small door opened into a privy, with a bench of polished wood and a nosegay of pungent herbs and flowers to mask the faint scent of night soil. The study seemed the most likely place to start. In short order, he found a reinforced lockbox on the mantelpiece and set to work with his picks. His fingers were clumsy with the cold, but he got it open in the end. Inside was a bewildering assortment of keys arranged in stacked wooden trays. Each had a small paper label attached, with the door that it matched written there in tight, neat Croden. Grubb frowned as he pored through them. Mudslug had made him memorize the Croden word for vault, but he didn't see it here, and even without the labels, Grubb's instincts said none of these were right. Even the largest keys didn't look, well, vaulty enough. Somewhere else, then. This key was too important to keep with all the others. He began to search the desk, but the sound of approaching footsteps stopped him, and he froze as he heard voices outside the door.
"Can I help you?"
"Overwatchman Clisson," said a moist voice.
"You are a hard man to find, Master Ban." "I went to the kitchens to fetch myself a dish. Is there some problem?"
"Let us in, please." Grubb felt a jolt of alarm as he realized that Clisson had been standing outside the door the entire time waiting. Frost and bones, if he'd been heard.
Of course. Could one of your men hold this while I get my key? Careful, it's hot. Am I in some kind of trouble?
Just open the door. One of your men. There were more of them outside. Grubb rushed over to the window with its broken pane, closed and bolted it. He'd never be able to squeeze back into that recess in time, but he could pull the curtains and cover it up, sweep the glass under the desk with his boot. The window had a lattice design, so he'd only needed to knock out one small square to reach the bolt. The architects hadn't anticipated burglars clinging to the wall high above a fatal drop, but those architects hadn't met Grubb. The key rattled in the lock as he hurried into the bedroom, searching for a place to hide. Under the bed? Too obvious. In the wardrobe? Just as stupid. There was nowhere a cursory search wouldn't reveal him. The door in the study opened. With no other choice, Grubb darted into the privy and pulled the door shut behind him. Maybe they wouldn't look in here.
"Search the place," said Clisson.
Grubb rolled his eyes and swore under his breath. He heard armoured men clump into the study, the screech of a chair as it was pulled aside. The Master of Key's chambers were small. They'd only take moments to find him. In desperation he went to the privy hole, stared down into the blackness as if it might offer him escape, but there was no way he'd fit in there. They were in the bedroom now, opening doors, looking into the wardrobe and under the bed. His heart thumped against his ribs as they came closer. He cast about for some way to avoid discovery, hoping for a miracle to present itself. But he was in a tiny room not much wider than he was, with only a narrow bench of polished wood and a hole for the master's doings. There was nowhere to go. A thought struck him. Unless...
"Look in there," said a voice from outside.
The door was pushed open. An iron guardsman, sword in hand, poked his head into the room. He lingered there a moment, perhaps tickled by some sense that something was wrong, but it was an empty room with no corners to hide in. He grimaced and pulled the door shut.
"Privy," he said. "There's no one here."
Grubb listened to their footsteps move back into the study, then let out his breath through lips drawn taut with effort. He was pressed against the ceiling above the door, having jammed his feet against one wall and his shoulders against the other. Silently, he dropped down to the floor.
"He, he, he. Grubb is the greatest,"
he whispered to himself, and made an obscene gesture at the door and the guards beyond.
"Now, perhaps you can tell me what this is all about?"
The Master of Key's voice was shrill with worry. "When did you last examine the vault?" Clisson asked.
"At sixth bell, as usual."
"And everything was in order?"
"Of course."
"Where is the key?" Grubb pressed his ear to the privy door. This he was eager to hear. The master began to bluster.
"The location and nature of the key are closely guarded secrets."
"Is it safe?" Clisson demanded.
"Assuredly."
"Show it to me."
"Over watchman, I cannot. It's simply that—"
The iron hand take a dim view of those who impede their efforts to protect the Empire, Clisson said. "Are you a loyal subject, Master Ban?" Grubb felt a grin spread across his face. That was a nice piece of bullying. He had to respect a fellow artisan.
Perhaps I could just show you,"
the master wheedled.
"Very well. You two, guard the door. No one comes in or out but me. The Master of Keys is confined to his chambers until further notice."
But...
"You have a meal, don't you? Books?"
"Well, yes."
"Then you should be well entertained." The door opened and closed as the guards left. No escape that way, Grubb thought. Lucky that was never the plan.
"Now," said Clisson, "show me the key. I want to know that the Ember Blade is safe." "Why is everyone so concerned with the Ember Blade today? Nobody can reach it in the vault."
"Who else has been concerned?" Clisson asked sharply.
"An odious woman who latched on to me. She was obsessed that thieves might steal it. A terrible bore. Rude, too."
"What was her name?" Clisson's voice was like creeping frost.
"And what did she look like?" "Lady Harforth of Harrow. Tallish, I suppose. Grey hair, short. You know how women cut it when it gets straggly. Sad when they go to seed that way."
Grubb's grin widened. Even in his predicament, it was fun to hear somebody abuse Bossy Chops behind her back.
"Here is the key," said the master.
"That's the key?" Clisson sounded surprised.
"Indeed. You see, if I twist it like this..."
"That is like no key I have ever seen."
"It fits in a recess in the door, and you turn it. There is only one, and I wear it at all times, hidden in plain sight. It cannot be taken without my knowledge, and no thief would recognize it for what it is."
"Ingenious," said Clisson, reluctantly impressed. "Your medallion is the key. I never would have guessed it."
"That is precisely the point," said the master. "I trust you are reassured, Overwatchman."
Clisson made a concessionary noise, already focused elsewhere. "Stay in your chambers," he said. "Lock the door. I will speak with this Lady Harforth." Grubb heard the door open and close, and the key turned in the lock.
"Yes, your spectacled magnificence,"
the master sneered venomously as soon as Clisson was safely out of earshot. Grubb heard the master muttering to himself as he lit the fire in the study. He arranged his platter and cutlery to his satisfaction on his desk. Then he came striding into the bedroom, straight to the privy, where he opened the door. Grubb stabbed him in the throat, bearing him backwards onto the bed. With his hand pressed over the master's mouth, he stabbed him again and again, his knife darting in and out. Flabby flesh ran with blood, sliced into gory blubber. The master's eyes gaped comically wide. The only sound was Grubb's heavy breathing, the creaking of the bed, and the thud of the knife. When the master went still, Grubb took his hand away from his mouth. The silk sheets were sodden red, and he was waxen now, his mouth in a slack gape and his eyes far away. Grubb snorted. If ever proof were needed that men were just mannequins of meat constructed by the bone god, it was there in death. All that mattered were the stories you left behind. The master's medallion was on a heavy chain around his neck. Grubb tugged it over his head and wiped away the blood with his palm. He had no eye for design, but didn't think much of it. A falcon, the Crodans liked that bird, was set inside a border decorated with the motto of the Sanctorum. He'd seen it about enough to know it. Diligence, temperance, dominance. Well, the last one sounded good to him, at least. He turned it this way and that, examining it with his clever hands. He found one hidden clasp and another, and then he pulled it apart, separating the medallion into a pair of thin discs. One had 2 dozen metal teeth, like the teeth of keys, protruding from its flat inner edge. The other had holes to accommodate them. "Huh," he said. He'd found the key to the vault. It wasn't quite what he'd expected.